Most of our conversation today has centered around men's soccer. What about women's soccer? The U.S. men's national team is good, but they're certainly not great. But the U.S. women's team? Well, they're the best in the world.
Yep, and that is literally true.
Back with me in the studio, our producer Michael Simon Johnson.
The last FIFA Women's World Cup was 2015, and USA took home the prize. Team USA has won 3 of the 7 Women's World Cups, which is more than any other country. We've won 4 of the 5 gold medals in Olympic women's soccer since they first started in 1996.
So, yeah, we're the best.
For now, yes. But check this out. Let's take a look at the U.S. men's team roster.
Okay, I'm looking at... Okay.
What do you see?
I see a lot of cute men. Okay, I see a lot of diversity here. I see names, like, from all over the world, literally.
Yeah.
Alejandro
Bedoya.
Yeah, like, but also all different races. So a lot of diversity here, yeah, on the men's team.
Okay, now let's look at the women's team.
Wow. So not a lot of diversity here, and actually a lot of them have, like, the same kind of look, long blonde or brown hair. It's a lot of white faces.
Yeah, it is.
It's not a lot of diversity.
It's a very white team. So now this is the question for a sport that is so deeply ingrained in Latin American culture.
Why are there no Latinas on the U.S. team?
In fact, why is there so little diversity on the team at all? To try to answer this question, I first went to Stephanie Young. She's a sports writer and a huge soccer fan.
Well, I started playing soccer like a lot of American kids around 4 or 5. Your parents just sign you up for community soccer and you go have fun with your friends for an hour.
Stephanie wrote a really thorough article on this whole topic. She says she started watching the sport in the mid-90s, and I asked her what women's soccer was like before that.
Before 1996, it was pretty dire. You couldn't really watch it on television. There wasn't much women's soccer to watch on television. The United States program had been going, I want to say, for about a decade at that point, and they'd already won a World Cup in 1991, but nobody was really paying attention, and FIFA didn't really care about that World Cup either. It was called the, I believe, M&M's Championship for the World Cup.
No way.
Because FIFA, they didn't want it to be associated with the actual World Cup.
It was actually called the first FIFA World Championship for Women's Football for the M&M's Cup.
And the women only played 80-minute games, I believe, instead of full 90-minute games. They wanted 90 minutes, but I think there was some... sexist concern about women running for 90 minutes.
That's absurd. The crazy thing about that is that it's not even like they took it from 90 to 40. Like, they just brought it down 10 minutes. They were like, how about
80? Yeah.
So the point is that women's soccer in this country is relatively young, at least as in terms of an organized sport.
Yeah, basically women's soccer has had to evolve much faster and far less organically than men's soccer. But even still, we were one of the only teams in the world even attempting women's soccer with any degree of seriousness. So who were they playing against?
I mean, a lot of nations had teams. You just didn't really hear about them. You know, Norway and Canada. I think Mexico had a team. China, obviously.
And both then and now, the U.S. women's national team was and is overwhelmingly white. And I asked Stephanie about it. So you wrote about this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is that? Why is the team so white?
It all starts at the bottom. By the time you get to the highest level of soccer, you're drawing from a player pool that's already fairly white.
She breaks it down like this. Most young kids play soccer at some point, but by the time you're a young teenager, you've either specialized in it or you haven't. And if you have, the best place you can go to is one of these elite private club teams.
You mean not high school soccer?
No. Even though high school soccer is ostensibly free from a parent's perspective, the clubs attract stronger talent. That's where you'll get noticed as a player. The thing is, those clubs come at a price, which is why they call it the pay-to-play system.
Which is exactly what it sounds like. You have to pay a fee, and oftentimes you also have to pay for, you know, equipment. And then depending on what level of soccer you're playing, there will be travel costs and tournament fees. And if you're in an elite club, like a high-level club that says, you know, we can get your kids scouted for the national team or for a professional club, then you may end up paying in, you know, several thousand dollars a year at this elite level.
You're saying parents are paying.
Parents,
yeah.
Yeah. I've seen clubs with costs as high as $7,000 a year at the top end for, you know, 15 and 16-year-old girls.
And we actually found one of those elite 15-year-old girls living in Brooklyn, New York.
I'm Angela Aguero. I'm 15 years old. I play with a team called World Class, which is in upstate New York. And I'm half Dutch and half Dominican. And I play with the U15 girls national team at the moment.
U15 means the national team for the 15 and under age bracket. There are only a few dozen girls on that roster, so basically she's one of the best youth players in the entire country.
Wow.
And as you can imagine, she's not playing high school soccer. Like she said, she plays for this regional club team called...
Did you say that the team is called World Class?
Yes, World Class. It's a good name.
She plays with them every week, and her dad, Miguel Aguero, says World Class is expensive.
You know, we're talking about almost $3,000 a year, plus all those tournaments that they put together, and then it adds up, you know, $5,000 to $7,000 easily, you know, per child.
And obviously, there's nothing explicitly racial about this, but Stephanie Young says you have to consider the socioeconomics.
If we're looking at like median incomes, this is from, I think, the 2013 census for Black families, it was about $34,000 plus. So what family on $34,000 can afford to pay even, you know, $1,000 in fees, let alone $7,000 in fees to get their kid onto an elite travel club? The census said in Hispanic families, it was $41,000. That's still not much better when you're talking, you know, looking at a $1,000 fee.
And for comparison, median incomes for white families is around $57,000 a year. So it becomes pretty clear that generally, the parents who can afford to pay for their daughters to train on these club teams are white. Take Angela's team.
Yeah, well, on my team in World Class, most of the players on my team are white, just like American white. Like, there's like two Colombians on the team, and then there's like me. But yeah, there's like three out of like 20 girls that are just like Latino, and then the rest are white.
And that's it.
That's it.
Does it come up ever?
It's like a norm, I guess. No one really talks about it. It's just like expected almost.
Yeah.
The team.
Well, that's something that I didn't know a lot about, which is the money about it. But it does make you wonder how many talented players Angela isn't playing with just because they can't afford to join the club.
Totally. And it keeps going. These expensive club teams are where the top colleges for women's soccer scout from.
Penn State, Stanford, UCLA, Duke.
These are the schools where Angela is applying, and most of them are pretty expensive.
Those are kind of like the top soccer colleges, and most of the players in the Professional League for Women are drafted from those top colleges. So yeah, that's definitely the place where you want to be.
And the people who can afford to do all of that are generally white. Okay, Michael, but help me to understand. What makes it so that the U.S. men's team is so diverse, but the women's team isn't?
The main difference is college. Male soccer players don't have to go through the American university system the way women do because men's soccer is a global marketplace. Landon Donovan, maybe the greatest American male player ever, went straight to Germany after high school to play professionally. Edgar Castillo on the men's team graduated from high school and went straight to Mexico because why not?
And because the United States has the most developed women's program, then the only place that they can actually play is right here?
Effectively, yes. There are just far fewer slots for professional women players because women's soccer just isn't as developed globally. And Stephanie says that even as the sport continues to grow and other countries get better, maybe better than us, she doesn't think it's necessarily going to add more diversity to the U.S. program.
There's already so many players who come through the NCAA who are good enough to go into the program
that we don't really have to change the system to compete internationally. But Stephanie says there's something else to all this, too. It's not just the team or the league, but how girls, specifically girls of color, around the country see themselves.
I was probably about 7, and we had to draw ourselves for a class, like draw yourself as an adult. And I drew myself as blonde and blue-eyed. And my mom found it and said, what is this? Is this how you see yourself? I didn't see the problem with it. because I had no concept of myself as not white or what it meant to be Asian. And so I think that you can extrapolate from this and certainly apply it to women's sports. If you're an athlete and you grow up and never see anybody who looks like you, it can deter you from thinking, oh, this is something I can do. Or it robs you of a certain part of your identity because you then think, oh, I have to be this way in order to be successful. And you then start to deny a part of yourself maybe that you shouldn't.